Good morning and welcome to the old federal building here in Anchorage. It's a pleasure to be here. Judge Pius and Nguyen and I are delighted to be in Anchorage to hear the oral arguments this week. And today we have our docket begins with United States of America versus Clyde McKnight, and that case has been submitted on the briefs. So I believe we can proceed with the next case set for oral argument, which is Keene Alexander Crawford versus Arnaldo Hernandez. So if the council ready to proceed, you may come forward. Please state your appearance.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Dan Polson. I am the Assistant Federal Defender representing Keene Alexander Crawford. I'll just get into it. Over 35 years ago in Ake versus Oklahoma, the United States Supreme Court recognized that when an indigent defendant can make a showing that his mental state is going to be a significant factor at trial, the Constitution requires at minimum that the state provide the defendant with access to a competent mental health professional who can assist the defense in the evaluation, preparation, and presentation of the defense case. This is a habeas appeal, which raises the question of whether the Alaska Court of Appeals unreasonably applied Ake when it upheld the denial by the trial court of expert funds to a pro se defendant who was representing himself on charges of first degree murder. There are three arguments for why the Court of Appeals decision represents an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. First, the Alaska Court of Appeals was unreasonable to assume that a pro se defendant like Mr. Crawford is not entitled to expert funds under Ake. The respondent is essentially arguing for an exception to the rule in Ake that would...
Well, did the state court said he wasn't entitled to it or that he hadn't made the showing necessary to secure it?
Well, and that's the second point I want to raise, which is that the Alaska Court of Appeals, I think, was unreasonable in holding that Mr. Crawford's requests were insufficient to trigger the protections of Ake, and that he had somehow failed to establish that his mental state at the time of the offense was going to be a significant factor at trial. That was an unreasonable application of Ake, and I think that the Court of Appeals applied a standard that
How was his mental state going to be an issue at trial?
So I think the trial judge remarked towards the end of trial that this was a case about Mr. Crawford's being choked unconscious, that his consciousness lack of consciousness in the immediate aftermath of the assault by the alleged victim was an important factor. That was the heart of the self-defense claim.
Let me ask you, was he charged with first-degree murder?
He was, and he was found not guilty on first-degree murder and convicted on second-degree murder. But this was a self-defense case, and so Mr. Crawford...
Well, the state still had to prove the elements of first-degree or second-degree murder.
Correct, yes.
Was his mental state at issue in either of those crimes?
I think it goes without saying that the government has the burden of proving that he acted with the requisite mental state. But I think especially in a self-defense case where he has the burden of showing that he was reasonable in his belief that his life was in danger, and where he's made repeated showings, and I can go over that with you, but there were many opportunities for the trial court to rule on Mr. Crawford's requests for expert funds.
That was the later stricken notice of experts differentiated between a psychiatrist and a medical expert on the physical effects, I think was the word, words used, of strangulation and loss of consciousness. And I just wanted to ask you, how does that factor into our analysis regarding whether Crawford properly invoked his Ake rights to a mental health expert?
Right, and so I think the respondent is arguing for, I think in their brief, they're arguing that Ake is limited to just psychiatric witnesses. Our position is that that is a far too narrow reading of Ake. I don't think you can confine Ake to just the specific facts of that case. And just to reflect, you know, Ake is a case involving an insanity defense and a capital case. And the expert was necessary for the guilt phase of the proceedings. In McWilliams versus Dunn, however, you have a question of an expert witness being called for mitigation purposes at sentencing. The point is that you can apply Ake to different, you know, procedural contexts. And the important part, I think, when you read McWilliams and Ake is that the court is not really hung up on the credentials of the expert, whether it's a neuropsychiatrist or a neurologist or a psychiatrist. Ultimately, the question is, has the defendant established that their mental state is going to be a significant factor at trial such that a mental health professional, an expert, is necessary to ensure that the outcome of the proceeding is fair, that we have confidence in the verdict.
As it turned out at trial, was his mental state explored?
I mean, he testified at trial, and he elaborated on what was going through his mind. I think that, and to be clear, I think the Court of Appeals was unreasonable to say that he just didn't place the issue in question. If you look at, for example, on August 10th, Mr. Crawford files a notice with the court asking for expert funds under Alaska Administrative Rule 12E5. He gets a denial from the trial court on September 2nd, saying that no court funds are going to be allocated for an expert witness. He renews his request. He gets another denial by the trial court, saying the request is denied for the reasons previously stated. He then files, and this is, I think, critical, and I really want the court to hone in on this. He then files on September 9th a pleading in which, and it's referenced in the Court of Appeals decision, he files a pleading stating that under Ake versus Oklahoma, he is entitled to funds to get a witness. He specifically invokes
Let me ask you this. It's not uncommon, I imagine. It wasn't uncommon in Los Angeles Superior Court, and I imagine it's not uncommon in a lot of other state jurisdictions, if he'd been represented by counsel, for the trial court to ask counsel for some sort of proffer on the relevance of the expert to basically play out the needs, right? It's not, just because you say, well, I need 10 experts on these five different issues, we're not just going to get it. So some sort of proffer, I imagine, is not unusual. Would you agree with that?
I would say that Mr. Crawford's ability to make that proffer was thwarted in numerous instances by the trial court's refusal to even take up the issue. And I think what
Tell me how.
Well,
who blocked him from making a more specific proffer as to the relevancy of his need for a medical expert?
I think that when the court says that no expert funds are going to be provided to you as long as you represent yourself, that's a pretty emphatic denial. That's a clear-cut denial that says that under no circumstances are you going to be getting expert funds.
You do mention that in your briefing. You discussed that the trial court conditioned, and it looked like more than once, Crawford's access to experts on appointed representation. But the Alaska Court of Appeals didn't answer the question of whether that was constitutional, did they?
They never got around to answering the question. They left it open, which I think is troubling because they basically passed the buck. They said that this is a political question. The legislature can get involved in figuring out how a pro se defendant is to be getting expert funds. And it's not a political question. It's a legal one. But,
Does that play in at all to our decision on whether or not the Court of Appeals here was unreasonable, the last reasoned decision was unreasonable?
Well, we think that they made a couple of mistakes. One, assuming that Ake didn't apply to a pro se defendant, that was unreasonable. Second, that his requests were insufficient to trigger the protections of Ake. I think the record is replete with I would disagree, Judge Wynn, that Mr. Crawford's requests do qualify under Ake as specific requests for a mental health expert. But third, even if
the state court faulted him for not articulating the theory that he ended up presenting at trial and articulated on appeal, which is that he was choked, he was rendered semi-conscious or unconscious, came in and out of consciousness, and that that upon regaining consciousness, his ability to perceive reality was impaired to the point where he mistakenly believed that the victim was attacking him with deadly force.
Yeah, and
so he never quite articulated it to that degree of specificity. I take it that your argument is that under Ake and Caldwell, he doesn't need to specify that level of detail?
Well, I think that the Court of Appeals did a bait and switch. I think that they, on the surface at least, it sounds like they're applying Ake, but the standard that they're actually applying is more in line with the rules for giving a notice of expert under Alaska Rule of Criminal Procedure 16, meaning he didn't provide the substance of the expert's testimony. He didn't give the expert CV. I'm not sure that there's any authority for that. Like, if you look at Ake and you look at McWilliams, in McWilliams, the defense counsel simply said, you know, I want a second opinion, right? And that was sufficient to trigger Ake. So I think that the Court of Appeals was applying a standard that doesn't appear in Ake. And I think it was unreasonable to expect that a pro se defendant is going to be able to state, you know, my theory is that if I, you know, I'm going to call a neuropsychologist who's going to testify as to the effects.
I thought the rule is a pro se defendant is held to the same standard as if he'd been represented, right? That's what judges tell pro se defendants all the time when they elect to represent themselves. It's like, you are you sure you want to do this? Because you're going to be held to the same standard as a lawyer.
Yeah.
And so if a lawyer is expected to develop the theory more, then that standard presumably would also apply to the defendant.
Well, and I think this case is unusual in that Mr. Crawford was never given the opportunity, I think, to make that full fleshed out argument because the trial court repeatedly told him that you weren't going to be getting expert funds as long as you're a pro se.
Did any of the standby counsel give him any kind of...
They attempted to. Well, and that's the thing is that standby counsel was appointed in May, and there was an expectation that that standby counsel was going to help him line up expert witnesses by the time, I think, August 3rd. Mr. Crawford was complaining that the standby counsel wasn't helping him and Mr. Crawford on his own had to cobble together a request for expert services. And again, that was the request that gets denied repeatedly by the trial court.
You know, I can remember many times admonishing defendants that they shouldn't go pro se,
but it's
ultimately have the right to do it. And, you know, nonetheless, we appoint standby counsel because we knew that they couldn't really...
I think Mr. Crawford...
articulate their positions clearly.
Right, and I think that the respondent's position is untenable to the extent that they're saying that, well, you know, you're a pro se defendant, you've basically forfeited your right to a fair trial, that somehow the protection, that the state is off the hook in terms of trying to provide you with a fair trial because you've chosen to represent yourself.
Let me ask you this, should it make any difference that a pro se defendant may not be entitled to? I mean, is that, you know, pro se defendant
I think it's
indigent? Does that make any difference in whether or not they're entitled to expert witnesses?
Well, I think the respondent is citing cases that basically say that if a person has either pro bono counsel or they've retained counsel, that the state isn't obligated to fund those expert services. And we've distinguished those cases because those don't really apply to a case involving a truly indigent defendant, somebody who is representing themselves. And Mr. Crawford ultimately did proceed without the assistance of standby counsel.
Let me ask, I understand your argument that you think that the state court unreasonably heightened the standard here. Do you think applying the unheightened standard, would Mr. Crawford still succeed here?
Well, and we're arguing that the Court of Appeals was unreasonable in failing to account for the trial court's actions, which if this court finds that Mr. Crawford didn't, you know, sufficiently lay out his theory and why he needed this expert, that's attributable to the actions of the trial court. I think the Court of Appeals decision gave short shrift to the actions by the trial court.
I thought the trial judges in multiple instances where there were multiple trial judges really tried to help them out. At one point appointing Mr. Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, yeah.
Tell me what happened with that, because I recall at one point in the record at one of the pretrial conferences when they were talking about whether yet another trial continuance would be necessary. I thought either the prosecutor or maybe Mr. Pawlowski indicated that a strangulation expert was in the offing, and then it sort of just dropped off. Is there an indication as to what happened with that? Did Mr. Pawlowski go research that?
Why
did it just drop off?
There were, I know that Mr. Pawlowski submitted, you know, billing, compensation for, you know, time spent trying to locate experts, but Mr. Crawford explained that he didn't get any assistance from Mr. Pawlowski and that Mr. Pawlowski didn't help him in those endeavors. And again,
That wasn't true, was it?
I'm sorry?
That wasn't true, was it?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals quibbled over the fact that Mr. Crawford was able to cobble together a request for DNA services, expert services, but that was again without Mr. Pawlowski's assistance, to my knowledge. I realize I only have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to stand down and the respondent make its case. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Diane Wendlandt. I'm an assistant attorney general with the state of Alaska, and I represent respondent Arnaldo Hernandez in this federal habeas appeal. There are three reasons why the district court's ruling should be affirmed. First, there is no clearly established federal law requiring Alaska to provide non-psychiatric experts for indigent criminal defendants. That can be found in footnote 1 of Caldwell versus Mississippi, where the court specifically says that it has not decided that issue. And this court has repeated that in both Jackson versus Ilst and Schrader versus Primo. The second reason is that there is no clearly established federal law that prevents Alaska from bundling the traditional benefits of representation with that representation. I need to point out, Alaska is unlike a number of states which have appointment of counsel, but without the provision of services. And so that appointed counsel must come to the court and ask for approval. That's what happened in Ake. That is not what happens in Alaska. Alaska has a centralized public defender and Office of Public Advocacy that by statute and funding, they have their own budget. They do not have to ask for a court's approval for experts. And so if an indigent defendant agrees to be represented by counsel, that money is there, but it is bundled. Now, Ake specifically says that it is allowing the states to decide how to provide funding for the psychiatric expert. It did not say that it must be separate. It did not say that you have to write a check to a self-represented indigent defendant. So at this point, without anything clear from Ake or Caldwell, for that matter, there's nothing that would prevent the state from bundling those services. And then the question finally becomes, does bundling in some way impact the right to self-representation? And Ferretta makes it very clear that, yes, a defendant has a right to represent themselves, but with that, they are waiving not merely the right to counsel, but to the traditional benefits of counsel. So I don't believe, and in fact, if you look at Kane versus Garcia Espitia, the court said, no, you can't simply argue that this affects my ability to represent myself. And so in the context—
Well, sure it does, doesn't it?
Excuse me?
Sure it does.
Oh, I agree that it affects the fairness of the trial. There's no question about that. But the lack of counsel affects the fairness of the trial. And when you have given up that right—
So when you give up the right to have counsel, you give up your right to a fair trial?
You have given up your right to the traditional benefits that come with counsel. And there is no dispute that as this court and the U.S. Supreme Court and
even
our courts have said—
ask for expert services?
I'm sorry.
Even though I could understand if maybe there was no request, but even if you ask for services, you give up your right to a fair trial because you're representing yourself? That seems counter to Ferretta.
Well, in Ferretta, it's very clear. The court says when you decide to represent yourself, it is extremely unlikely that you're going to have a fair trial because the vast majority of people cannot adequately represent themselves.
And we sometimes appoint standby counsel to make sure that they have some resource to help them.
That's true. And that was done here. The problem is that Crawford wanted so much more. This really is not a case about, gee, he wanted one expert, couldn't you have written a check? That's not the problem here.
This isn't just about giving him a check and saying, go find an expert.
Exactly.
As Judge Wynn suggested, he needed to make some showing. This is why I want an expert. This is what I need. And the court could approve it or not approve it.
That's correct. If AIC applies here, then that's where the Court of Appeals went next.
Assuming that it does apply, what type of showing does he need to make?
Well, first of all, it's clear that although there was a September order saying that these services are bundled, if you want funding for your expert, you need to accept counsel. After that, however, that was by Judge Smith. Two other trial judges handled this case. Judge Volin briefly took it over. Mr. Crawford again asked for experts, and Judge Volin said, I don't know anything about that. You're going to have to put it in writing. And Mr. Crawford did not. Then the case went to Judge Arseth, and Judge Arseth, in response to this, again says, tell me where you have made a request that I can actually vet. You haven't given me enough information to determine who it is that you want me to appoint, how much it's going to cost, how it's going to fit with your defense. Now,
how isn't that counter to Aiken and McWilliams?
Aiken, it's interesting because in Aiken, you have a very specific request for a psychiatrist that fits within the systems that states already have. They have.
McWilliams, further elaborate on that. Are you saying they have to use the magic word of psychiatrist? Otherwise, when they put their mental health at issue, they get no services.
What I'm saying is twofold. Number one, if they want something that falls within Ake, Ake is very specific in its balancing of Matthews versus Eldridge. It talks about the importance of insanity and guilty but mentally ill issues, that those are crucial to finding criminal liability, and the importance.
McWilliams?
McWilliams was the same thing, where basically in McWilliams, the state provided a psychiatrist, or I believe maybe a neuropsychiatrist, who did not actually assist. He was just objective and did an evaluation, but he did not actually provide the type of assistance that Ake was saying was necessary.
Let me ask you, in your briefing, you discussed, I guess I wanted to ask you specifically, did the Court of Appeals decision find that Crawford did not request a mental health expert, in your view?
Yes.
What was he asking for?
He was asking for a medical expert. That's what he kept saying. And the fact is, part of the problem here is that.
Why did he want a medical expert?
Prior to trial, it was not entirely clear. And I know counsel has pointed to various places in the trial where it does become clear. But this decision was made prior to trial. And at that point.
I thought there were some of the documents show that he was complaining about or raising the idea that he had been choked prior to the shooting.
If you go back through the thousands of pages of record.
That's why he wanted an expert, was to opine on the effects of that.
If you go back through the record, a lot of this was done orally, so you have to review the transcript. And at the time, the trial judge would not have had a transcript.
But
at the time.
Go looking at the record, it seems that the record is replete with examples of Mr. Crawford asserting a self-defense theory involving his strangulation and loss of consciousness. So I'm trying to figure out, why wasn't it unreasonable for the state court to say that he never informed the trial court of the theory of defense?
Because by the time this came to Judge Arseth, there had been a massive number of written pleadings, there had been numerous hearings, and through that, if you take bits and pieces and you stitch it all together into a quilt, you see the big picture. But the question is, did the trial judge on the eve of trial, what he said was, look, make a written request. And that's where this becomes most important, is during those November hearings, Judge Arseth said, okay, fine, make me a written request. Tell me what you want, why you want it, what it's going to cost. He knew how to do it. He did it with the DNA request.
Did Ake require a written request? I don't remember that.
Ake probably might not have, because Ake was not the problem we have here. Here, again, it brings me back to my original point, which is he didn't just want money for a medical expert. He needed someone to find that medical expert. He needed someone to communicate with that expert and to hire that expert. He needed an answering machine, so if the expert called him, he'd know that call came through. He was in jail. And
indications in the record that his last standby counsel, Mr. Pawlowski, attempted to find him a strangulation, so-called strangulation expert?
The record is not totally clear, but there is a reference to the fact that Mr. Pawlowski had charged for 2 or 3 hours of time spent looking for what I think is referred to as simply an expert. So we don't know what kind of expert, whether that was the DNA expert or a strangulation expert. And then Ms. Carey got involved later. But in August, it's interesting, before the September order, in August, Mr. Crawford fired Mr. Pawlowski and said, I understand, I don't want any more standby counsel. I am going to find my own experts. And at that point, Judge McKay said, okay, how much time do you need? I need 3 months. Then when you get to November, Judge Arsa says, again, what do you want me to do? And that's really the question here. What was the judge supposed to do?
Let me ask you this. You know, at the end of the trial, or towards the end of the trial, if I read this correctly, the state made a request that it needed an expert to counter his testimony. And the trial judge said, wait a minute, you knew from the very beginning of this trial that his mental state was going to be at issue. Now, if Judge Arsis was sort of blind to the record, where did he get that?
Well, by the end of the trial, yes, it was absolutely
clear. But it was really interesting. He didn't just say, you know, during the course of the trial, this came up. He said, from the very get-go.
And that's fine.
From the start, you knew, state, that his mental capacity was going to be an issue.
And I don't think that was
correct. No, we're not going to take a break to let you get an expert because you knew.
Certainly, by the time this trial started, they knew. But I think that the judge was wrong if he was suggesting that it went all the way back to the beginning of the case.
Well, maybe I
because
that. If I'll go back and reread it again.
If you look at
the judge was wrong, not that Judge Pius was wrong. You're saying
No. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Not you. You
the judge was wrong.
Judge Arsith was wrong. And if you look back at Judge Arsith's statements in November, it's very clear that he's saying, look, you've given me these vague, ambiguous requests for a medical expert or another type of strangulation expert or something. I need something more. Put it in writing. Tell me who you want. But the problem is, and there are several times where a judge said, look, because Mr. Crawford kept coming back and saying, I want to do this orally. And he said, no, I need you to put it in writing so that I can take this to the administrator and explain what's going on here. And at that point, he said, the problem is, Mr. Crawford, you've been pushing this case really hard, and if you want me to do that, if you want to put this in writing, you're going to need to take a trial continuance, and Mr. Crawford said no.
You said, you know, you need to look at the big picture. If we step back and look at the big picture, it looks like the Court of Appeals in Crawford 1 noted that that central to Crawford's self-defense theory was the effects of strangulation and loss of consciousness on his perception. So I guess my question, isn't the Crawford 2 finding directly contradictory to that?
No, because basically what the Court of Appeals was looking at was in hindsight. And in order to decide whether the judges acted improperly pre-trial, you have to look at the information available to them. And a trial judge, prior to trial, has very little information beyond the indictment and the pleadings of the parties. The judge did not know exactly what this case was about, how the prosecution and defense theories would play out. He only would know that if Mr. Crawford came forward. But even coming forward with a theory was not adequate because, what was the trial judge supposed to do here with this? I need a medical expert. And you can see Judge Arsith trying very hard and saying, look, who is going to find that medical expert for you? You need to give me something.
At the same time, I mean, it was done in conjunction, or wasn't it? Let me ask you, with statements like, well, you can't get an expert because you're representing yourself unless you agree to have a representation. Was that correct?
That was correct.
That was correct, not only factually, but you think under the law you can't get an expert unless you decide that you want not to represent yourself.
For non-psychiatric experts.
Psychiatric? Because that seems counter to McWilliams. I don't think you're acknowledging. You didn't acknowledge it in your brief. You're not acknowledging here today. Why don't you tell me, if you don't mind, what we should take from McWilliams?
My recollection, and maybe I am misremembering, Your Honor, my recollection is that McWilliams was provided a neuropsychiatrist, although I could be wrong there, and that the issue in McWilliams was the fact that this person, this expert, did not actually play a role in assisting the defendant, and that was the problem.
Because it seems, in my view, that McWilliams plainly laid out three triggering conditions, which I think arguably were met here for the ache rights to attach. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell me why they wouldn't. And that was decided a few months before Crawford 2. but the state didn't cite to that case or apply that test. Should we take anything from that?
I'm not sure I'm following. The Court of Appeals in Crawford 2 basically
didn't cite to McWilliams at all, which seems like it probably could have and should have, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell me, you know, that we shouldn't take anything for it for a particular reason, or because it seems like McWilliams laid out three triggering events that arguably Mr. Crawford met.
But again, that brings us back to, this is unlike the situation where you ask for a psychiatrist, where there are specifically people available to be appointed, and you know exactly what needs to be done, who needs to be appointed. Here, we have a very ambiguous request for a medical expert. There wasn't any request saying who was going to be appointed, and there isn't a stable of people.
But I understand representing the state here, but the request for the expert was tied to how he felt at the time that this murder had occurred.
But how he felt at the time, I mean,
to his thinking, said that he was conscious. And then if you look at the elements of a first degree or second degree murder, it seems like that's relevant. But you're saying that was not specific enough, even despite Williams? McWilliams?
What Crawford asked was not specific enough. What he specifically asked for was someone who could talk about the physical effects of being strangled. And that's only if you go back and sort of piece together, because he would ask for something, but then later on he would say, oh, well, here's my defense. And again, we went through several judges here, and even if it had been a single judge, it was still a significant period of time. And Judge Arthas kept coming back and saying, please, I'm willing to reopen this issue, even after Judge Smith's order, but you have to put something in writing that I can vet. And I don't have that right now. And you could not expect the trial judge to go back and search through the thousands of pages of pleadings and all of the hearings to sort out whether there was a sufficient request.
And I think what you're arguing is that right there, what you just laid out, that that Judge Arseth requesting it in writing and the need to have it in writing supersedes McWilliams.
Depending on your reading of McWilliams, yes. Because there has to be something specific. And I don't believe that saying to Mr. Crawford, look, you keep saying vague things, and I don't know what you're trying to do, and you keep expecting me to read your mind. Just put it in writing. I will review it, but you're going to need a trial continuance.
But you're not saying that it has to be in writing. Had he made an oral proffer that counsel would have made, that would be sufficient under the Supreme Court case law, wouldn't it?
It would. I assume it would. But the problem is his proffers were not specific enough. And to make matters worse, they were so spread out into bits and pieces. I don't think it's improper for a judge to say, look, under these circumstances where Judge Arsus had experience with Mr. Crawford, he knew how these things went with Mr. Crawford, and he had trouble pinning down in hearings what exactly Mr. Crawford wanted. So under those circumstances, it was reasonable for the judge to say, fine, I'm not going to do this orally anymore. Put it in writing.
Is there any place in the record where the judge sort of teased out from Mr. Crawford why he wanted a medical expert? Like,
no.
You say, well, why Mr. Crawford, do you think you need a medical expert or whatever kind of expert you want?
I don't believe that that's in the
record. Explain to me what it is you've got in mind. And there's one point in there where he says it's about an ex parte situation. He says, don't go too far. Don't say too much, because the state's right here.
That was just
you don't want to reveal your defense. I mean, it seems like what the judge should have done was, and I know, this is not doesn't really play, but you know, he could have said, well, you know, we're going to go ex parte, and you can tell me what this is all about.
And there are many places where things could have been done differently here.
Yeah, I understand that.
But the question is not, could it have been done
differently? No, that's right. That's I want to assure you, I understand that.
So at this point,
with this record as it is.
Exactly. And the question becomes, did the trial court and the Court of Appeals violate clearly established federal law in handling the situation as they did.
They unreasonably apply clearly established.
Exactly, exactly.
Or unreasonably determine the facts.
Exactly. That is the standard here, and for the reasons stated in my brief and here today, I believe that the defense has not met that, Mr. Crawford has not met that standard.
And even though he repeatedly told the trial court, or informed the trial court that he was concerned and he wanted an expert because he was being choked unconscious and he did not really know how many times he came in and out of consciousness. And he testified he had different perception of the facts as a result of being held unconscious for a period of time. And after being choked unconscious and after coming to and stumbling outside, apparently there was a lot of references, or I don't know, maybe you dispute that, kind of look at some of the different record sites, where he says he wanted the expert because he had become in and out of consciousness and wasn't sure what he was thinking. So you don't think that put his, that was specific enough, and he, and in your view, he needed to put it in writing?
It was not specific enough, whether it was put in writing or not. That is a separate question, because Judge Arthas was saying, I am willing to relook at all of this. That's when the request for putting it in writing came, and that's when Mr. Crawford said, I don't want a continuance. I'm considering this done. What happened earlier, I'm sorry, I'm way past my time.
I'm sorry, I've taken you out of time. If you want to make a concluding statement, you can.
Okay, just briefly in conclusion, under the facts of this case, first, it was not unreasonable for the state trial court to refuse to apply AIC to a request for non-psychiatric expert. Second, it was not unreasonable for the state trial court to enforce Alaska's decision to bundle traditional benefits of representation with representation itself. And finally, in any event, it was not unreasonable for the state appeals court to find that Crawford failed to make an adequate request for expert funding in this case. For these reasons, respondent asks this court to affirm the district court's denial of federal habeas relief.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So if you can first address what I think is your counsel, your friend across the aisle's main argument is that his request, your client's request was not specific enough.
Right, and if you read the Alaska Court of Appeals decision, you would think that that was the reason why Mr. Crawford's requests were denied. The fact is, if you look at the trial court record, it is not the case that the trial court denied Mr. Crawford access to expert funds because his requests were vague or too unspecific. The fact is that he was denied access to expert funds because he was representing himself. And I would alert the court to May 2009 at a hearing before Judge McKay, in which Judge McKay, and this is conceded by the respondent, that Mr. Crawford would be entitled to expert funds under Administrative Rule 12E5.
There was some confusion there because it's a chicken and egg thing between different trial judges as to, well, how do you get these funds right when you're representing yourself? But ultimately, he was appointed standby counsel. Let me just ask you, just as a practical matter, and I have to say, share some of the trial judge's frustration going through this record. As a practical matter, he's incarcerated. He's chosen to represent himself, right? The judge appointed standby counsel to try to assist him in pre-trial matters, including searching for the experts that he wanted. What should a trial judge do under the circumstances? The trial judge isn't going to go out there and interview and gather the experts for him. At some point, with repeated continuances, he's got to come up with names, CVs, and that ultimately was why his notice of expert was really stricken. So
I
think appointing standby counsel is just about the most practical thing that the trial court could have done under the circumstances, no?
So his standby counsel abandoned him. That's important. But the point is that I think we've actually overlooked something about the trial record, which is that the Court of Appeals said, like, well, Mr. Crawford did make a sufficient showing that he needed a DNA expert, but the trial court found that it wasn't relevant to the case, right? So We would disagree with that because when Mr. Crawford initially asked for expert services in August, and then again in September, the orders that he got.
He fired Mr. Pawlowski. Mr. Pawlowski was searching for an expert.
I think there was some indication that he had billed for searching for experts, but.
He billed for hours, spent searching.
Right, and then what effort, or what came of that?
He was looking for an expert.
Right, but what came of that is non-existent. I don't see anything in the record that says that Mr. Pawlowski actually followed through. All I can say is that he billed like 1.7 hours, I think, for those services. But Mr. Crawford made it very clear that Mr. Pawlowski was not assisting him in his endeavors, and the filing for DNA expert was something that Mr. Crawford cobbled together on his own. And the initial response, and I can't stress this enough, the initial response in the order that Judge Arseth affirmed, because Judge Arseth refers back to Judge Smith's ruling and says like, well, Judge Smith made this ruling. Judge Smith's ruling is you're not getting expert funds, buddy. You're not gonna get expert funds because the court system has limited funds. You're eligible for court appointed counsel. You're not getting this money. And that is the effect.
Does the record show that Mr. Crawford was trying to reach out in an attempt to secure experts all the way up until the trial?
Well, I'd call attention to the pleading that he filed on September 9th. It's the affidavit and request for expedited hearing on funding of necessary defense services. He asserts under IG versus Oklahoma that he's entitled to public funding for necessary investigative and expert witness services. He points out that the court had previously said he could get funds through Administrative Rule 12E, and that now the court is implying that those funds are not available. He gets no response to that.
So what should have happened is the district court or the trial court should commit to the, I'm just trying to think like as a practical matter, what you want to see happen, and then go back and see whether the law dictates that he has that right. So you're saying what should have happened as a practical matter is the court has to commit to a certain fund first to say, okay, now I'm gonna authorize $5,000. Good luck, do the best you can from prison to try to interview an expert, and then tell me who that expert is, make a proffer, provide the CV, et cetera, so the prosecution could then secure a rebuttal expert. That's what should have happened.
Right, I think the preliminary, I think Mr. Crawford's ability to make that preliminary showing, that sort of need, got sidetracked, it got derailed by the fact that the court was hung up on where is this money gonna be coming from. And that's, I think, what ended up resulting in this confusing trial record because nobody knew.
So what case law from the Supreme Court dictates that procedure that the trial court has to commit the funds to him first in order to assist him. As a practical matter, I understand why Mr. Crawford was struggling when you call up experts and then you try to get them to support your theory of the case. Well, some funds would have to be committed that would make it easier for him to secure an expert. I just don't see any authority from the Supreme Court saying that that has to be the procedure employed by the state.
Well, procedural questions aside, AIC is about access to justice, right? It's about the fundamental fairness. It's not about, and contrary to what the respondent argues, it's not about right to counsel. AIC is not a Sixth Amendment right to counsel case. It's about sort of the basic building blocks, the tools that you need to mount a defense. And to the extent that the Court of Appeals and the trial court were preoccupied with the procedural, the mechanical aspects of trying to get money appointed, it had the effect of totally denying and thwarting and depriving Mr. Crawford of his constitutional rights. That's the effect of the Court of Appeals ruling, and that's the reason why we're saying it's unreasonable.
The state says that this administrative part of this and trying to get the funds, that was not unreasonable, I guess, for the state court of appeals to say that because of all of the complications that Judge Nguyen just went through, that was sufficient reason to not be able, and because people forego certain expectations of how fair the trial is going to be when they're going to represent themselves.
Well,
how do we balance that? Because it is a difficult question here. I do sympathize with the judge and the judges who I think were trying to figure out this process. So what do we do with that?
Well, I think bottom line, the trial court needs to be consistent. And there are conflicting rulings in this case, in the sense that he gets shot down by one judge. Later, and I'm sorry, first he gets a judge who says, we'll commit some, we have money available for expert funds. He goes in front of a different judge, he gets shot down. No, those funds aren't available. By the time he comes around to the November 2nd hearing and he's bringing the issue up, the trial court's order and the trial court's Judge Arceth's language to him is, there's never been any, there was never a promise to Mr. Crawford that he was going to get funding. Now try to wrap your mind around that. He's a pro se defendant, and apparently he has, I mean, apparently the trial court has about as much sort of knowledge about the mechanics of AIC as Mr. Crawford does. There's really, I mean, these inconsistent rulings, I think, had the effect of thwarting his ability to get, you know, for his constitutional rights to be protected. I think that's the fundamental problem. That's the issue that the Court of Appeals glossed over in its analysis. The trial court needs to be consistent. You know, I realize that pro se cases are difficult, and certainly there's difficult, you know, issues about funding, but that shouldn't be a justification or an excuse to basically terminate a person's due process rights.
So does there need to be a clear ruling from the Supreme Court on this issue that Judge Wynn was asking you about?
No, I mean, because again, it's about access to justice. Did the Alaska Court of Appeals, did the Alaska court system give Mr. Crawford access to justice?
Under AIC.
Under
AIC. You have to tie it to
right.
a
Correct.
Supreme Court case, and it
right.
has to be AIC.
Right.
Or McWilliams, or both.
Right, and Ferretta, certainly, because,
Ferretta.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank
Do you have
so
anything
much.
Else?
I will leave it at that, and I...
thank you.
Thank you
thank
so
you
much.
Thank you both very much. This is a very interesting and challenging case. Really appreciate both your oral argument presentations. The case of United States, I'm sorry, Keene Alexander Crawford versus Arnaldo Hernandez is submitted.